You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of July 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the programme, as the death toll from a derailed train in Galicia approaches 80, we'll ask what effect the tragedy will have on the business of train travel in Spain.
Also ahead in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House's Middle East and North Africa programme.
And listen up, this is the sound of the future of the music industry. We'll be asking if YouTube does have the answers to record labels' woes. Universal Music has set up a label to harness the popularity of the video site. We'll find out how.
Plus, we head to the roofs of New York for this week's edition of The Urbanist.
For the best views of New York City, you really can't be in the center of it all. You have to be on the outskirts. There's a great penthouse space that's way, way over on like 10th Avenue or 11th Avenue in Midtown. But it's great because the whole city opens up around you.
All of that. Plus, we will play some music too. That is all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
First, though, let's catch up on the latest world news with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The number of people killed in a train accident in the northwestern Spanish region of Galicia has risen to at least 77. Nearly 150 more were injured when all 13 carriages of the high-speed train from Madrid to Ferrol came off the tracks near the city of Santiago de Compostela. 73 people died at the scene, with a further four dying in hospital. It's believed to be Spain's worst rail accident in four decades. The head of the regional government has described the scene as Dante-esque. Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy, who was born in Santiago de Compostela, convened an emergency ministerial meeting late on Wednesday. He's due to visit the scene later today. Monocle's man in Madrid, Liam Aldous, told the Globalists that the cause of the accident has not yet been established.
And they're putting it down to excessive speed, but there's not much detail yet, because this section of track was actually repaired recently to be able to handle speeds of up to 220 kilometres an hour, and the train was apparently going at about 180 kilometres an hour. So there's something else seems to have gone wrong. Perhaps the train's signal systems perhaps failed. This is one of the theories being put into play.
The disgraced Chinese politician Bo Xilai has been formally charged with bribery, corruption and abuse of power. The former chief of the Communist Party in Chongqing was expelled from the party following a scandal over the death of the British businessman Neil Haywood. Last August, Bo Xilai's wife, Gu Kailai, was jailed for the killing. The state-run news agency says Bo Xilai took advantage of his office to accept an extremely large amount of money and properties. The US says it wouldn't be appropriate to continue the delivery of F-16 fighter jets to Egypt amid the unrest that erupted after the military ousted Mohamed Morsi as president. The move came 2 weeks after the US suggested it would go ahead with the delivery of four F-16s. On Wednesday, Egypt's military chief, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, called for mass rallies to take place on Friday to give him a mandate to tackle the unrest. But opposition leaders say it could encourage more violence. US State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki also has concerns.
We have certainly seen General Sisi's speech in which he called for the Egyptian people to take to the streets on Friday against violence. We reiterate our call, which we have done publicly a number of times, as you know, but also in private conversations with him and others on all participants in the process here, that any demonstrations be peaceful. We are concerned that clashes would make it very difficult to reconcile and get ahead of cycles of unrest and instability.
Pope Francis has taken a firm stand against legalization of drugs as a means to fight drug addiction and criticized the trend in Latin America to decriminalize narcotics. In his first public address on the issue, the new pontiff said education was the way to end drug use. The Pope made the statement while visiting a new treatment facility for alcoholics and drug addicts at a hospital in Rio de Janeiro as part of his week-long visit to Brazil. President Obama says reversing U.S. economic inequality should be Washington's top priority. In a major economic speech at Knox College in Illinois, he described the slow recovery in place in the states. He faces a battle in a few months' time with Republicans in Congress over the budget and raising the debt ceiling. And he criticized Republicans at length, challenging them to develop their own economic plan.
We're willing to take a few bold steps. If Washington will just shake off its complacency and set aside the kind of slash and burn partisanship that we've just seen for way too long, if we just make some common sense decisions, our economy will be stronger a year from now. It'll be stronger 5 years from now. It'll be stronger 10 years from now.
And the president has also announced that he'll be nominating Caroline Kennedy, daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy, as ambassador to Japan. Kennedy, who trained as a lawyer, is president of the John F. Kennedy Library Foundation and chairs an advisory committee at the Institute of Politics at Harvard University. The 55-year-old is active in Democratic politics and was an early and prominent supporter of Obama's in his initial quest for the presidency in 2008. Her appointment is subject to Senate confirmation. Japan has welcomed the news. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Bonnie, thanks very much. It is 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We're live from Studio One in London, and it's time now to set the day's agenda. Three big stories from one part of the world that you should know about for the next 24 hours. Delivering said stories this morning, Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Jane, nice to have you here. We often speak on the phone, but here you are in the flesh. You're real.
I am real. Good morning. It's
wonderful.
Exciting.
Wonderful news. Well, nice to have you here. Where would you like to start today?
Well, let's start with Egypt. You've already flagged on the news the US holding up a sale of F-16, seemingly in an attempt to put some slight pressure on the military. And the top general, El-Sisi, has been calling for mass protests on Friday in support of what the military is calling its war against terrorism, a very American phrase to use, basically for confronting the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's an interesting twist in Egypt now to see protests being backed by the might of the state. And you see, for instance, the pro-government news TV channels are saying that on Friday they'll cancel all the Ramadan soaps that families normally watch, and instead they'll just be broadcasting 24 hours of protest. You know, this is not something optional. This is something, you know, being spoken of as a sort of patriotic act. But it is very worrying. There's been an ongoing sit-in in Cairo by supporters of the Brotherhood. This may be an attempt to get cover to dismantle that. And meanwhile, the Brotherhood supporters are saying it's tantamount to a declaration of civil war. 150 people are estimated to have been killed in July, and there are worries about violence on Friday.
We've mentioned the idea before that the Muslim Brotherhood, or some members of the Muslim Brotherhood, have predicted that this might happen, that the military would orchestrate a situation that would give them a legitimate means to crack down violently on Muslim Brotherhood protesters. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you've seen violence already. You've seen several tens of Brotherhood supporters killed, particularly at one sit-in outside a security building pretty much immediately after the overthrow. So there are good reasons for them to be worried. Having said that, they also probably underestimate the nature of the opposition. They've always had a tendency to see the opposition to them as being the product of a conspiracy, and the recent events have increased their feeling that that's the case.
The Muslim Brotherhood's rise came about because of lots of reasons, of course, but one of them being that they were the most organised and it seemed a logical place for people's support to go. And so it did go to them in great numbers. Now we have this situation where clearly the Muslim Brotherhood are going to be against what's going these military decisions going on. But then presumably you have everybody else in the middle of this situation. Where's the feeling about where the sort of majority view lies, and what sort of options people have at this point?
the political scene is quite fragmented now. I mean, you did see what seems like the majority of the population coming together to say we don't want Morsi anymore. But that brought together all these groups that were very strange bedfellows, from supporters of the former regime to more hardline Islamists to young revolutionaries to older generation liberals, very, very wide ranging. And those groups are beginning to split over their attitudes to the army. The other Islamists particularly are quite unsure what attitude to take now because they find it hard to team up with the army. And the only issue is that none of them are that organised a political force. You know, you're seeing lots of small groups. None of them can really keep the army in check unless they find ways to work together better.
And as a result, when you hear of the army saying, OK, we have a roadmap towards a democratic election in the next couple of months, given the recent events and given Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's, you know, calls to protest, is there any genuine belief that elections that might take place will be anything other than not free nor fair?
It's incredibly risky. I mean, the tradition in Egypt for decades has been to use real security concerns, but to exaggerate them and use them as reasons to repress opposition. The country.
It sounds like a throwback to Mubarak straight away.
These are familiar tactics. It's very likely that the military will be tempted to use those sorts of tactics again. They talk about it, wanting to include the Brotherhood, but most of its senior leadership are in prison. So there are questions about how they're going to participate in the elections. There is, however, some Western pressure. The West generally hasn't wanted to go directly against the military, but they are putting pressure on, saying you have to go ahead with elections and the Brotherhood should have a role.
Jane, let's move on to a second story that you flagged up for us today. And it is separate, but it's connected. Well, literally connected, in fact. We're in Gaza.
So you're seeing that what's happened in Egypt having ramifications throughout the region, and Gaza next door, which is run by Hamas, an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, has really been suffering as a result of the changes in Egypt. The military has never been keen on Hamas. There's been a lot of insecurity and some militant attacks in the Sinai recently, which the army has been sometimes pointing the finger at Hamas for. And they have been basically really tightening up control of the border. So it's now extremely difficult for residents of Gaza to come out of Gaza. The main exit before was through Egypt. And the UN has said they cut more than 80% of the tunnels that are used for smuggling to get around the blockade. So ordinary Gazans, many of whom don't support Hamas, are again stuck in the middle. Fuel is in very short supply. Concrete isn't coming in. Other reports from Gaza are suggesting that 90% of the construction projects are now on hold because they just can't get building materials.
It's astonishing to think that the immediacy of the effect of the closure of these tunnels, isn't it? What does it say about Hamas's future now that it no longer has the Muslim Brotherhood next door to give it a help?
They're really on the back foot. It's incredible how quickly things can change, because this time last year, we were seeing the group becoming stronger and stronger, getting support from Turkey, getting support from Qatar. There was actually a mini economic boom in Gaza, believe it or not, because these countries were putting aid in. But suddenly, the ruler in Qatar has changed, the Brotherhood's gone in Egypt, Turkey is losing influence in the region. Hamas is really stuck, but they still have the monopoly of force in Gaza. So you're not seeing them go out of power. You're just seeing them become poorer and more paranoid.
Well, let's look at another dimension of a similar situation, of course, all interconnected. And we'll go to Syria now, where a new UN team's arrived looking for evidence. What are they looking for evidence of?
There have been accusations for months that the regime in Syria has been using chemical weapons. And it's important not just because it's important in itself, but because this is something that the US has said before is a red line. But it's not very clear what they're going to do about that red line being crossed. The regime has responded by saying that it's actually the opposition that are using chemical weapons and that they've been making homemade nerve gas. For some months, the UN's been trying to get in to verify the claims. The regime has obviously decided it's better to let the UN in, but try and control them. So they're meeting with a lot of officials. They're being allowed to visit one site where rebels are accused of using the nerve gas, but they're not getting access much beyond that.
Obviously, the there is the idea of Russia here having its say, because obviously Russia has now supported the Syrian authorities by supplying them with arms.
Sure.
Where does this leave the UN and Russia? Because it suddenly becomes a very difficult and delicate process now internationally.
Well, to be effective at Syria in any way, the UN requires Russian buy-in. That's one of the main reasons why the UN has generally been so ineffective. So the UN is trying to take what it would see as an even-handed approach. They're going in at the invitation of the authorities. They're listening to their point of view. The risk is that the authorities actually prevent them from seeing anything.
Jane, we'll have to leave it there. But thank you very much for coming in to see us today. Jane Kinnamont.
Nice to see you.
From Chatham House. Nice to see you too.
Up next, we head to Spain to assess the damage done to state train company Renfe after the recent crash in northern Spain.
All this week on Monocle 24, we'll be turning our attention to Korea. In the lead up to the 60th anniversary of the end of the Korean War, we'll look back in time. We'll be finding out how the big divide and the constant military threat has shaped the psychology of two nations. We'll be delving into the inner workings of South Korea's Ministry of Unification. And we'll be hearing the soldier's story from an often ignored military campaign as we try and make sense of an impenetrable and often mysterious regime. So join us as we take a deeper look at Korea, all this week on The Globalist. That's at 1400 hours in Seoul, 0900 in Dubai, and 0600 here in London. That's on Monocle 24.
At least 77 people have now believed to have died after one of Europe's worst rail crashes. A train carrying more than 200 people derailed last night outside Santiago de Compostela. At this point, it's being treated as an accident. There's speculation, however, that the train was travelling at twice the speed limit in the moments before the crash. Several of the train's carriages overturned, some caught fire.
A local official has described the scene as shocking, as Dante-esque. More than 130 people are thought to be injured as well. Santiago de Compostela is in national mourning today on a national holiday. Let's look now at what the incident could mean for the operator in charge of the train, Renfe, and for train travel in general in Spain. Miles Johnson is Madrid correspondent for the Financial Times. He joins us on the line now. Miles, welcome to Midori House. Perhaps you could start by explaining to us how exactly train travel in Spain works and where Renfe fits into this.
Well, Renfe is the state operator and controls all of the lines in Spain. There are different types. I mean, Spain has one of the sort of most celebrated train networks in Europe after a long period of investment, and has high-speed trains which run from Madrid to several other important cities in Spain. And Renfe has generally had a very good reputation and a growing reputation across the world, and has increasingly sort of been taken on by other countries to advise on the development of high-speed trains. And so this incident is obviously not very helpful for its reputation.
You mentioned there that they operate internationally. Where do they go? I mean, it's good to see that a Spanish company is doing so well in terms of its influence. But how much damage do you think that this incident will do?
Well, I think it's obviously a very tragic incident, but I think it should be sort of placed into perspective that this was, as it appears now, a sort of human error which could have happened anywhere. It doesn't necessarily reflect on Renfe's sort of safety record. It is operating, but it's increasingly in part of Spanish consortiums, which are competing with other countries, predominantly the French, to build high-speed rail networks in foreign countries. So one of the big sort of marquee contracts was the contract to build a high-speed train between Mecca and Medina in Saudi Arabia, which was a contract which the Spanish consortium and Renfe won. And so increasingly they are being recognized as world leaders in high-speed trains. But I think at this incident, it would be unfortunate if it were to reflect on Renfe in these markets.
Obviously, this investigation into the accident is in its very earliest stages. But of course, the blame game starts early. And at the moment, it's not looking good for Renfe and who was responsible for this.
Well, yes. I mean, at the moment, obviously, we don't have all of the facts, but there is speculation that, you know, the train was traveling at too fast a speed. And obviously, that suddenly doesn't look good for the people who were involved in that. But, you know, I think these accidents can happen anywhere in the world. And it's just particularly, you know, it's a particularly horrific accident, this. And it's very unfortunate. But I think that it's very hard to say at this point if there was anything which was actually systemic within Renfe or the way trains are operated. It could well just be sort of very unfortunate human mistake.
It comes less than 2 weeks after a French train crash in which 6 people died. This doesn't look good for European rail travel as a whole, which up until now has genuinely enjoyed a very good worldwide reputation.
Yes, I agree. I mean, in the sense that, you know, in Spain has, you know, as I said, had this sort of celebrated reputation for its train network, and it's certainly unfortunate at a time when the country is increasingly dependent on tourism to boost its economy, that there could be even the slightest lingering concern about the safety of its network. And I think that, you know, it's a very difficult thing to reverse. I mean, it will be these images which are going to be broadcast across the world, and, you know, will unfortunately probably have some form of residual impact on the way people perceive both the safety of trains in Spain and in Europe as a whole.
Well, indeed, it comes 2 weeks after that incident. It comes some 9 years after, of course, the bombing of a train in Madrid. I said in the introduction that immediately this wasn't thought to be anything other than an accident. But presumably, the news as it arrived last night must have been pretty worrying and brought back bad memories for Spaniards.
Absolutely. I mean, although there's absolutely no indication at all that's had anything to do with terrorism, just the very nature of a train accident and bodies being taken from, you know, a torn apart train evokes very painful memories for Spain due to the attacks at the Atocha station in 2004. And so the moment these images appear on, you know, national news broadcasts, it really does sort of bring back the sort of awful memories of that moment. And so it's a very, very evocative and very sensitive subject matter in Spain.
Miles Johnson of the Financial Times in Madrid, many thanks as ever for coming on the show.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tóquio.
London, New York, Tóquio. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back here with Midori House. Today with me, Dominic Reynolds and Emma Nelson. We're going to play Name That Song. Carefully, it's a tricky one. Okay, that was easy actually, wasn't it? But there's a reason it's so easy. Psy's Gangnam Style is one of the great successes of YouTube, of course, racking up no fewer than 3 billion views. Can that be right? 3 billion views? That's extraordinary. For his two hits, Gangnam Style and Gentleman. Like it or not, it's an indication of the way the music industry is heading.
Universal Music has responded with the launch of a new label devoted to launching new artists via Google's video site. All Deaf Media will attempt to harness the astonishing popularity of the likes of YouTube. Joining us in the studio is Marie Alicia Chang, who's co-founder of the music industry data analytics company MusicMetric. Thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio, Marie. Just explain to us how widespread this influence of YouTube has now been. I mean, Gangnam Style was pretty much the pinnacle of its influence, wasn't it?
Right. So when we launched our digital music index September last year, which was the industry-wide report that we had, it was very interesting to note that in terms of play counts online, Vevo as a social network and YouTube were most dissimilar, mainly because all the artists that you have on Vevo are signed. And at the time of the launch, Psy and another Korean artist, Big Bang, were at that time the two biggest artists on YouTube. And their play counts have really gone through the roof. I mean, with Gentlemen, I think, Psy actually overtook Justin Bieber as the sort of fastest growing sort of online video view. So what we've seen with this incredible partnership, actually, is that it's a milestone cementing the recognition of how important social media has become today in any campaign.
And I suppose the way what constitutes the selling of a piece of music is changing, isn't it? I mean, in the last sort of 6 months, we've had the Billboard 100 in the US recognizing streaming data as part of as one of the metrics, I suppose, that informs its top 100. And at the same time, we've seen these sort of extraordinary, sort of quite controversial, salacious videos from the likes of Robin Thicke, Justin Timberlake, which really push the envelope in terms of what's acceptable in order to, because there is such a great potential. And if you can get people to watch a video, you can really get them into that sort of purchasing kind of process. So we're seeing things change at an incredible rate, aren't we?
I think we definitely are. I mean, you know, as most people understand with YouTube, it's a huge discovery engine for young people and anybody really that's interested in new and emerging content, in it, particularly with music. So what we're seeing here is that selling music and using the digital environment as a tool to do that is the campaign. It's not just an afterthought. So this partnership shows how important it is to be looking at online digital data. And in fact, we see that with a lot of our clients who want to focus on which artists are bubbling up in which territories. So brands more than ever now seek us out for that kind of information because they want to know what's big online, you know, what should they be aligning their band to. And on record labels, you know, they want to be able to see how their band is reacting and, you know, their artist is being engaged with in different territories and on different social networks. And this is all really important.
There is that difference, though, that you just pointed out, that Universal wants to sell its music online. The great joy of the likes of YouTube is that people can access it completely for free. And that doesn't give you a very promising business model, does it?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, YouTube was originally seen by the industry very much as the anarchist. And now it's interesting to see that Universal Music is partnering with a channel to precisely do, as you've said, to drive revenues from that. And I think that's about two things. I think it's more than just about revenues. I think it's also about, and I think Russell Simmons, who's the guy who's behind it, as we know, All Deaf Music, who launched the likes of LL Cool J and Beastie Boys. It's this idea that, you know, they want to take the intuition that has always been very part and parcel of the music industry, but putting some kind of hard data behind that. So having a feel for when they see these, because a lot of it is user-generated content, you know, like just as Justin Bieber was. So when they see these sort of user-generated pieces of content, what they want to do is to think like a record label and say, with the right promotion, with the right stylist, you know, with the right thing behind it, could we repackage this and put it back up on YouTube and see if this actually then has more weight to get away from the noise? And it's that kind of, you know, putting things out there, assessing, analysing the data to see how users are engaging with it, that is actually very interesting.
How does all of this play into the fact that we've heard in, the last year that the single sale has seen a massive resurgence? For years, it was the format that was dying. You know, in the days when people were paying sort of £3 or £4 in the UK for a single song and a couple of B-sides. Now, people can buy things instantly, and increasingly sort of impulse buying, I suppose, is informing the kind of the process by which people are consuming music. So, I mean, are we seeing an interrelation between those two things?
I think that video views online definitely drive sales of singles. I think what we've seen is that you've got a huge amount of content that tends to be consumed in different ways depending on the kind of audience that you have. So some of it is very much, you know, the video-based stuff, whereas some of it is, you know, bigger on streaming sites such as Spotify or Last.fm or Audio. And then you've got other things which are huge on iTunes, you know, big download sellers, digital downloads or mobile downloads.
Marie Alicia Chang from Music Metric, many thanks for coming into the studio. You're listening to Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
To Buenos Aires.
To Toronto.
To Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour of today's Midori House, we will get the latest news from Jerusalem. We'll review this morning's Nordic Papers with our in-house Finn, Mr. Marcus Hippie, and we will head to the Ruse of New York for this week's edition of The Urbanist.
For the best views of New York City, you really can't be in the center of it all. You have to be on the outskirts. There's a great penthouse space that's way, way over on like 10th Avenue or 11th Avenue in Midtown, but it's great because the whole city opens up around you.
That is all to come, but first, Barney Burnham with your news headlines.
Thanks, Dom. The number of people killed in a train accident in Spain's northwestern Galicia region has risen to at least 77. 131 more were injured when all 13 carriages of a high-speed train came off the tracks near the city of Santiago de Compostela. The disgraced Chinese politician Bo Xilai has been formally charged with bribery, corruption and abuse of power. The state-run news agency says he took advantage of his office to accept an extremely large amount of money and properties. The US says it wouldn't be appropriate to continue the delivery of F-16 fighter jets to Egypt amid the unrest that erupted after the military ousted Mohamed Morsi as president. The move came 2 weeks after the US suggested it would go ahead with the delivery of four F-16s. Pope Francis has taken a firm stand against legalization of drugs as a means to fight drug addiction and criticized the trend in Latin America to decriminalize narcotics. In his first public address on the issue, the new pontiff, who's on a week-long trip to Brazil, said education was the way to end drug use. President Obama says reversing US economic inequality should be Washington's top priority. In a major economic speech in Illinois, he criticized Republicans and challenged them to develop their own economic plan. And the president has also announced that he'll be nominating Caroline Kennedy, daughter of the late President John F. Kennedy, as ambassador to Japan. Her appointment is subject to Senate confirmation. Japan has welcomed the news. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Now, this week on The Urbanist, Andrew Tuck is on the roof of Midori House, taking in the views and presenting us with an array of stories about other people's rooftops from around the globe. In this preview of the programme, we are in the US.
New York City is well known for its use of rooftops, from high-end cocktail bars to urban farms, exclusive swimming pools or casual barbecues. It's a city in which space-hungry residents have always seen the value in the extra square footage rooftops offer to a cramped metropolis.
For Nick Carr, they're also a good place for making movies. He's been a film location scout in the city for the last 5 years and says rooftops are a popular request. Pauline Eiferman met him on the rooftop, of course, of the building he scouted for his latest movie, a horror film set entirely in the Bronx.
Most commonly, I get asked to find rooftops that are right next to a major structure like the Empire State Building or the Chrysler Building, and this is always the wrong way to go because you can't see it. You realize, in fact, for the best views of New York City, you really can't be in the center of it all. You have to be on the outskirts. There's a great penthouse space that's way, way over on like 10th Avenue or 11th Avenue in Midtown, but it's great because the whole city opens up around you. Another great view is when you want the New York City skyline, don't be in the middle of it, go way south of it, go down in the village, and then you see the village, it's almost like rises up to these tall skyscrapers. Or get out of the city altogether. I mean, you go to Queens, you go to Brooklyn, and you go along the waterfront, and you see the whole city stretch out in front of you. But everybody always wants to be right next to the Chrysler Building, and then you get next to it, and it's not what you want, you know? So I started a website called Scouting New York, I think close to 5 years ago, where I write about some of the interesting things that I come across in my travels as a movie location scout. I try to highlight the hidden gems, so I've done a few rooftops.
So New York City is pretty much a city of rooftops, right? You have the bars, you have the restaurants, the pools. What else have you seen in your line of work that maybe New Yorkers don't know about?
I feel like rooftops are just coming back into being a thing that people are finally realizing you have this extra floor of space that you can use. So you have your pools, you have your bars. I think the coolest thing I've ever seen on a rooftop is some guy down in the Wall Street area put a plane on his rooftop and a whole landing strip. And it's not real, the plane doesn't work, it's a piece of art. But all the neighboring traders and everything in the Wall Street area would look down at the plane and wonder, you know, could you take off on this thing or whatnot. There was another rooftop where a guy tried to build a landing strip for his plane, and obviously it just was nowhere long enough. But he tried. So I guess you try to do whatever you can in New York with its limited space. I think the rooftops that really get me are the ones with the views that you just sort of don't expect, you just don't know about. So for example, there is a rooftop at, I was working on the movie Spider-Man 3, and they filmed on a rooftop at Central Park South, and I was there to let the guys in every day and stay overnight and then leave in the morning. And so, you know, you'd see the city at night with it all lit up. But what was really amazing was the next morning, Central Park just sort of spreads out north for 100 and whatever, or 50, 60 something blocks, whatever it is, and it looks like this blanket. And what's amazing is right as the sun rises, this sort of mist would rise off the park every day. And it's something that you could be in the park, you'd never notice. You could be around the park, you'd never notice. So it's not so much what was on the rooftop that was hidden, but the view it afforded that really opened up your understanding of what New York has to offer. And then people in New York City do this thing where they build houses on the roofs of their properties. There's one at the corner of First and First Avenue. It's literally looks like someone built a beach house on the top of the property. It's apparently a guest room that he lets guests stay in. At the corner of, I think, 11th or 12th and 3rd Avenue, there's another house on top of a three or four story brick apartment building. This one looks more like a clapboard style house. And then somewhere in the 80s, 70s or 80s on the Upper West Side, someone built what is basically a ski chalet on top of his house. I mean, I guess it's extra space, and in New York, you use that space as best you can.
And how do you find these places? Do you just walk around? Do you get tips from people?
It's a little bit of both to find these places. For things that you can see from the ground, if you walk around the same block six times, maybe on the fifth or sixth time, you'll be so bored with what you've seen every other, you know, turn around the block that you'll actually look up and go, oh, hey, what the heck is, what is that up there? Google Maps is great when you're looking for a rooftop pool, just going on the street view, or sorry, the Google Maps view, satellite view, and looking down and finding those rooftop pools. That's always good. There's not so many of them. And then, tips, people saying they want to get their building in movies and reaching out. There's an amazing rooftop at Central Park West. You know, what kills me about these things is when you have it, you tend not to use it, you know? So I get to go to these places and I'm like, this is amazing. And I swear to God, every rooftop I go to, there's no one up there. Like, they have all the lounge chairs out there. They have a bar, they have whatever. And there's just the tenants of the building are just never up there. And it's like, I guess it gets boring if you have it every day. I don't know.
Nick and I take the stairs down to the flat he's secured for this production. There, he shows me pictures of all the rooftops he's worked on for the past few years.
This gives you a good example of what rooftops look like when you go to the edge of the city. And what's so funny is, you know, this is probably, I'm standing on what must be sort of an industrial building of some kind, something that they have no use for. This roof. This roof does nothing for them. And just by chance, they happen to have one of the best roofs in the city, and they're not even using it for any purpose whatsoever. And which is great for us because it's easy to rent because nothing's ever going on. There's the city at night. That's kind of a midtown view. I guess we're somewhere in the heart of Midtown. This was for Spider-Man 3. You see all the buildings lit up around you. They wanted the highest places that he could jump off of, so that was my job for about a month, was they just kept sending me to rooftops that were the highest in New York, trying to figure out what the best one was to jump off of. This was used in a movie called Chuck and Larry. It's this Adam Sandler movie where he like marries his fireman or something like that. But anyway, this was a great rooftop because you can see it's a parking garage with this awesome view of the city. And so what they did was they, you know, I think one of them gets stuck in the vent or some stupid thing like that, but they zoom in real tight so the city gets real close to you. And that's an awesome parking garage, you know. Another rooftop, a lot of times we get asked to find a rooftop where the subway goes by, because, you know, I guess if there's two things that are iconic of New York, it's the city skyline and subways. So here's a rooftop where you get that.
Is that easy to find?
Finding the subway is the easy part. Getting the subway to agree with your shooting schedule is the hard part. And usually what they do is they'll put a PA down at the station who calls us on the walkie about 30 seconds before the train leaves the station, and then we just time it as best we can. If you watch the movies, I swear to God, everybody lives their apartment, everybody lives next to the subway in movies. Like, you look out the window and there's a subway going by. This was for the movie The Taking of Pelham 123, the remake. That's what they wanted, was the subway going by everywhere you could see. A lot of times people are looking for bridge views. This is a building in Williamsburg that has this awesome rooftop. Again, a government building. They don't use it for anything, and you think, man, what a waste of space. But it's used all the time for movies because you have the Williamsburg Bridge just shoot back into Manhattan. Now, the downside of it is you don't get anything really interesting from the skyline of the city. You just get the bridge, but the bridge, I think, sells it because everybody films here. And you also actually get southern Manhattan and the bridges. And then this is an example of why it's great to be on the outskirts of the city. This is over by 10th Avenue. Here you can kind of see how the whole city rises up, and from kind of like the 2-3-story buildings to like 60, 70 stories. And it's why being on the outskirts is a good thing.
So the trick is to not be too close.
Not be too close, kind of be on the outskirts, and yeah, get your view.
That was Nick Carr speaking to Pauline Eiferman for this week's high-rise edition of The Urbanist, all about rooftops. You can catch the programme in full tonight at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. We will be back in a moment with news of Israel's exports in arms going up. Stay with us.
If design is your beat, then tune into Section D, our weekly show delving deep into the latest developments in the worlds of architecture, fashion, furniture, product development, tech, and many more.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
No matter what the sphere, we'll be here with expert insights, news, and exclusive interviews on all things design. So switch on to Section D every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn, and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. It's 8:41 in London, 10:41 a.m. in Jerusalem. That's where we're heading now, because Joseph Dana's there rounding up the headlines for us where he is. Joseph, welcome back to Midori House. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. How are you?
Yeah, we're doing good in a nice aircon studio despite the warmth outside, so we're very happy here. Let's start by talking about Israel and its arms exports. They've gone up quite dramatically.
Well, absolutely. It's no secret that Israel has a very highly developed arms export industry, and yet it has in recent years been slumping a bit, largely due to the cutback in defense budgets across the world and the global financial crisis. But we got some news yesterday that exports have been up to the tune of something like $7.5 billion. And this is really quite surprising, and it's been kind of bolstered by a lot of growth by Israeli defense companies in the Asia-Pacific market, as well as some massive deals with India and Azerbaijan, which kind of, you know, I guess it's an example of the Israeli foreign policy in a sort of certain extent, because Israel has, over the last couple of months, really tried to deepen its footprint in the Asia-Pacific region. And so we've seen a lot more kind of arms trading and a lot more diplomatic activity coming out of that region for the Israelis.
How big a player is Israel on the global stage in terms of arms?
Well, consider the size of Israel, which is an incredibly small country. It's a massive player. There's rumors that it's now the top five arms-producing countries in the world. I guess it would be safe to say that it's definitely in the top 10. When it comes to UAVs and drone technology, as well as kind of advanced radars and air defense systems, the Israelis are probably in the top three. I mean, this is one of their biggest exports behind the United States in kind of, you know, getting these drones all over the world, which have become so popular for so many various governments across the globe, as it were.
It's kind of surprising to see anyone's arms exports going up in the current climate, where we see headlines perpetually about governments cutting their defence budgets. This is a bit of a surprise, isn't it?
It is a surprise, but I think that at least if we put on our kind of arms industry hats, the Israelis are doing it in a very kind of smart way. They have a lot of small and mid-sized defense companies, roughly 600 in a very, very small country. And because they're small, they're able to move, let's say, fast and light and able to get in on deals very, very quickly. And it looks like in 2013, the Israeli arms industry is going to continue its upward trend because of the recent, let's say, peace agreement. Agreement with the Turks, or the unthawing of negotiations with Turkey, we're expecting that there's going to be a lot more Turkish-Israeli arms partnerships, and so the Israelis are going to be sending a lot of weapons to their northern neighbor, as it were.
Joseph, let's move on to the issue of increased cooperation between Israel and Palestine. I mean, last week we had the announcement by John Kerry that both sides are going to talk about talking. There's now been some inward investment from Japan, of all places, which offers really good promising thoughts, doesn't it?
Yes, this is, I think, one of the most interesting entry points into the discussion about prospective peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Effectively, what we have is Palestinian and Israeli finance ministers meeting in Jericho, probably tomorrow, maybe even this afternoon, to talk about the economic relationship that the two entities have. As it stands now, according to the Oslo Accords from 1994, the Israelis basically consider the West Bank its own custom zone. And so the Palestinians don't have any control over their customs or their borders. And there's been some efforts by some of these Asia partners that we've been talking about, specifically Japan, to invest in some economic free zones around the Jordan Valley, specifically in the city of Jericho. So the Japanese have announced this week that they're going to be investing about $200 million to create an economic development zone between the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the Jordanians. Now, this is significant because this is exactly what happened before the Oslo Agreement. There was a lot of discussion about the economics of the situation and this term that's talked about all the time, economic peace. And so the fact that this is happening now might be a good indicator that the peace talks that we're expecting, or that we don't really know if they're going to happen next week, it might be a good indicator that they might actually happen and that there's some real force behind them.
Joseph, I want to move on to another story just briefly, if we can. And this is a new chairman coming to the Bank of Israel. Who's coming in, and what does it mean for the bank?
Well, this is a really fantastic story, actually. The chairman of the Bank of Israel, Stanley Fisher, an old IMF guy, is stepping down. He's done quite a good job, at least as far as the Israelis are concerned. And his appointment is currently a very senior executive in J.P. Morgan Chase, who used to be the Bank of Israel chairman from 1991 to 2000. His name is Jacob Frankel. Now, before he can kind of smoothly enter office in October, which is when he's supposed to take office, there's been a lot of controversy about an incident involving shoplifting in the Hong Kong airport duty-free. Apparently, Jacob Frankel was involved in shoplifting either a bag or some sort of perfume. It's unclear exactly what he stole and if he actually stole it, but this is creating a big, big controversy here. And there's actually some kind of, let's say, commissions happening in the Knesset as to whether or not the next Bank of Israel chairman could come in with a shoplifting blemish on his record.
And finally, Joseph, let's mention briefly another slightly odd story. The good people of Ramallah could be getting their absolute fill of Billy bookcases and antelope high chairs soon enough.
Absolutely. There's word, or at least an Israeli newspaper broke last week, that Ramallah might be getting its first IKEA branch. Now, the Israelis have gone absolutely mad for IKEA, and from what I understand, it's quite a good market despite its size. And there was some talk a couple of years ago when their second branch opened near Tel Aviv that IKEA might actually be able to deliver to the West Bank, effectively deliver from their Israel branch to Palestinians. Now, this was shot down because of quote-unquote security concerns, but there's this news last week that IKEA is looking into opening its own branch here, which in the West Bank, which would be a very big boon for the economy. I mean, there's not that many global kind of brands that exist in the West Bank, and there's even some word among Palestinians, I've heard, that John Kerry was using this as an incentive for Abbas to go back to the negotiation table, basically trying to sweeten the deal, saying, you know, if you go back to peace talks, maybe I can swim IKEA and Ramallah for you.
Well, if my local IKEA is anything to go by, it's good news for purveyors of Valium and anger management classes.
And meatballs.
Meatballs in Ramallah as well. Joseph Dana on the line from Jerusalem, thanks very much as ever for joining us. We will be doing a little tour of the Nordic region's news in a few moments. To get us there, this is Anne Brun with Do You Remember?
Time you being mine.
Anne Brun there with Do You Remember? Joining us now to guide us through the stories which have caught his eye from Nordic front pages today is Mr. Marcus Hippie. How are you, Marcus?
I'm very good, thank you.
You look well. You look well. Like you've been refreshed. Have you been away?
I've been on a holiday in Finland, funny enough.
Brilliant. So you've come back with some news-based tidbits for us.
I have indeed.
They're terribly deep.
They are terribly deep.
You go on holiday and you come back and you bring back fundamentals, Marcus. Everyone else would come back with stories of ice cream and beaches.
Exactly. Maybe it's because it's quite quiet over there at the moment because everyone's on a holiday. So I think that's when it's time to sit down and think of things thoroughly. And
do you all get terribly morose when you go on holiday then in Finland?
Sometimes we do. But you know, the big discussion topic that's been going on for weeks now is once again, guess what, Finland.
And no, not booze.
Again,
booze.
Yeah. No, really. Now there's one governmental minister who's come up with a new suggestion. She wants that beer is taken away from grocery stores. So basically, as a conclusion, if you want to buy any alcohol, you should always go to those state monopoly shops. And you probably know the name of them already.
Alco, isn't it?
It's Alco in Finland. We've been talking about this so much.
Wow. And there's this sort of psychological cat and mouse game between the government and the consumer of alcohol in Finland. It's a big fundamental issue, isn't it?
It is. It's a big discussion topic because it is a very important discussion topic, and it's got massive economical consequences. The state is spending a lot of money to compensate for the problems caused by alcohol. Even though at the same time, if I'm not all wrong, about 10% of Finns actually drink half of the alcohol. So it's not the majority, it's the minority that's actually drinking too much. So therefore, what's been often said is that if beer is taken away from shops, grocery stores, actually the majority is going to suffer and they don't have a problem with the alcohol.
Okay, so that's the consumer versus the state. Let's move on to the next big battle in your deep newspaper review. This is law versus religion.
Exactly, I like this title.
This is big. I feel like we need like a trailer voiceover for
don't
this.
Don't you ever have idle chats in Finland?
In a land where people drink too much, one man.
Just recently there was a religious festival in the north of Finland and Minister of the Interior of Finland, Päivi Räsänen, gave a rather philosophical speech over there. She was thinking about the importance of what your conscience says versus law. And basically her message was that if you feel like something is not right, what law says is all right to break the law. Which is kind of interesting considering that at the same time she is the minister responsible of the Finnish laws.
I find these absolutely baffling. I must confess, Marcus, that you would get the Ministry of the Interior telling a country to examine its conscience.
Exactly, and break the law if necessary. She was referring to abortion and some of the issues at the same time. There's a website in Finland where you can go easily, you can log on, and you can resign from the church. And once again, tens of thousands of people did that as a consequence. And that's happened before as well, where she's come up with some anti-gay statements. But shall we move on
to... She sounds like a delight.
She is a personality. If we move on to Stockholm, Stockholm housing market is one discussion topic in Sweden. It's practically impossible to get a flat from there easily.
No, that's really odd.
There was a case just a few months ago when someone had waited for a flat for 28 years, but that's quite exceptional. It's a very complicated system over there. There are many different ways of getting the right to live there. Quite often you don't actually buy the flat itself, but you actually buy a right to live in that. At the same time, you can still pay a lot for accommodation. There are some examples of Swedish banks giving you mortgages for 65, 70 years easily, which means that it's not even expected that you pay for the whole money. It's your children who pay the rest.
That sounds like a perfectly reasonable system.
So at the moment, the discussion topic is how to boost the building of new houses in Stockholm because the situation is so incredibly urgent over there.
How do they deal with it, though, given the fact that space is restricted?
Well, it's the same problem as in Helsinki. Helsinki's got a similar problem at the moment, and it's not so much about space that is restricted. There is space, but people often don't want to sell those plots of land away because they're waiting for their prices to increase. But if we move back to Finland for a minute or so.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm quite intrigued by this because apparently the police are asking for the public's ideas about what their vehicles should look
like. I love
like.
This story.
I've got loads of ideas.
They are basically renewing the whole look of that institution, not just the car, but all the forms, police cars and all that. And they're asking for people's ideas on what the colour should be.
And what have people said? Because I get the impression that the under-10s will be particularly interested to participate
well,
in the competition.
Yeah, they're drawing them on a regular basis anyway.
It's too bad that I don't...
world experts.
I don't actually know what's being suggested yet, but I do know that they have some art students actually finally in the judges, as judges, deciding what the final look is going to be. But I've heard that there's been some topic that lime green colour would be the new dominant colour.
Oh, that's just the beginning, though. I mean, you can have wings.
Well, exactly. I mean, I suppose on a slightly serious note, of course, there is a law and order implication, isn't there? Do you want your police car to look friendly and warm and approachable, or do you want it to look imposing and frightening and likely to keep people in order?
That's exactly the question, and that's what they're pondering about in Finland. Just before I go, I have to say one more thing.
Go
there's,
on.
There's one guy in Finland who's actually been doing work for Monocle 24. His name is Mark Bosworth.
Ah, yes.
He is our contributor, and all of a sudden when I was in Finland, I realised that he's become a national celebrity.
How?
For his work for Monocle 24?
He actually did a story on baby boxes, cardboard boxes filled with everything a new mother and baby can need during the first months. And he sold that story and it became an international phenomenon. And the biggest newspaper in Scandinavia did a whole page on him.
On him?
Congratulations
to the man inside the box. Wow. Well
Marcus,
done, Mark.
You've got to step up to the mark of that. Thank you very much indeed for joining us for now, though, with the newspaper review. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer, Ada John, and to our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gaia Lutz, and to our studio manager, too, Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is Culture with Robert Bound. I'll be back with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 8 a.m. here in London.
But from me, Dominic Reynolds.
And from me, Emma Nelson. It's goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.